Actually, I'll start by telling you a fun story. When we were filming the movie Finding Happiness, I'm in one small scene with it. We're in the expanding light dining room, and the heroine is talking to Purushota and myself about a course we've come up with on the future of consciousness and brain function, things like that. And it was so hot in there when we were filming. It was like 105 degrees because these lights would be dim compared to the lights they had, and they had banks of them. And they just shot all day, and it just got hotter and hotter. And I was starting to sweat through my shirt. So to keep me cool enough so that I wouldn't sweat on camera, they put me in the vegetable locker in the freezer at the expanding light in between takes. So people would come in, they'd be making dinner. They'd come in to get something, and I'd be sitting on cans, a stack of cans, cooling off. And it was the funniest thing because I'd be in there for like 5 minutes, and they'd be ready for another take. So I'd come out, and I would steam for like a minute. I just have the steam pouring off me like I was just on fire. And then I'd stop steaming, and they'd go, okay, shoot. And we'd go ahead and we'd do the take. And by then I'd start sweating again. They say, okay, back to the locker room. Anyway, so I have an odd association with being videoed when it's on. You know, I thought it would be fun tonight by starting with just a little bit of an overview, looking at the ways in which we physiologically are able to change. In fact, normally when I teach a longer course on this, I kind of frame the whole course around the question, who do you want to be in 6 months? Because it really gets at the point that either by choice or just by letting it happen, we are constantly in change. And there is the possibility for us to take charge of how we change so that this version that we will become in 6 months may be one of our choosing. The happy news is so much of what Master has given us in yoga fits well right within this window of looking at optimal ways of helping people make change. And we'll talk about three different areas tonight because I think you'll find this interesting from a perspective of Master's teachings, both with meditation and other things around diet, which for years I often wondered about, why did Master recommend this odd sort of daily diet with odd components like a carrot with the green top? And I would ponder this and couldn't quite figure it out. And I think there's actually a partial answer here that I can share with you tonight that actually begins to make some sense of this. So let's talk first about the nervous system. As Master said, the pathway for everyone spiritually, no matter what their religion, is through our own nervous system. In fact, one way you can look at it is the spiritual path is quite egalitarian. All of us have to work with our own nervous system, no matter what religion we happen to ascribe to. We're all going to have to work through that same fundamental reality. Happy news, we actually have quite a bit we can say about what we know happens when the nervous system with spiritual practices. It's actually been studied. There's actually a whole field now that's called neurotheology, where they study how spiritual practices affect the brain and nervous system, and also how the brain and nervous system may influence what kind of spiritual practices we choose by predilection of how our particular brain chemistry, neurochemistry works. So the first thing to say is it's helpful to remember with brain function that, as I think I mentioned this morning, that we understand now that the brain is very changeable. The term we use is neuroplasticity, neurochangeability. And literally, when you begin taking on a new behavior pattern, let's say it's learning to meditate, or maybe it's learning a new language, you know, kind of depends on what behavior you're taking on, is your brain is going to respond to that. It's sort of constantly waiting for you to give it an indication of what direction you're headed in, and automatically it begins reorganizing itself, not only functionally, but structurally. And for example, with the actual brain cells or neurons, you can kind of think of them as our gray matter or thinking cells in the brain, that we're actually constantly growing new neurons. I don't know how many of you grew up in an era where you were told after age 20, you didn't make new neurons anymore. It was, you sort of were stuck with how many you had, and it was a race between your neurons and the rest of your body, which wore out first. It was kind of a grim prognosis either way. And we know now people in their 80s are growing new neurons. So that's one thing. We make new neurons, and preferentially, we grow them in areas of our brain that's being used. So as we'll see, for example, when we're doing a meditation technique like Hong Sa technique or Kriya, which tends to really draw our energy and our awareness into the prefrontal lobes of the brain, it's the prefrontal lobes that tend to be really activated by these processes. And you see that by an actual change in the number of cells. The actual mass of the prefrontal lobes will increase. It's kind of interesting if you look at long-term meditators, people who've meditated for many years, they begin to shrink again, but it's not because you're losing brain cells or you're going gaga because of meditation. It's actually because your brain starts becoming a little more efficient, and it actually keeps rewiring itself to become more efficient. So that higher level of prefrontal lobe efficiency remains, but the amount of gray matter that's there actually shrinks down a little bit. But I think the key thing to remember is kind of in this first window, that is one of the ways that our brain begins to adapt and change its function is by growing new neurons. It also rewires itself. I mean, that's one of the things that probably has even a bigger effect, that it begins to try to optimize itself in how it is wired to best allow you to demonstrate the behaviors that it thinks you're trying to do. So, you know, the happy news is that so much of what Master said, you know, I remember reading those things that's like, I don't care if you're unhappy, smile. You know, something that simple, it turns out our brain is constantly watching stuff like that. And if we're smiling and we're making an effort to have a different kind of positive affect, our brain actually pays attention to that and begins to rewire itself to make that our new reality. So there's tremendous support for these very common sense things that Master gave us as recommendations, helpful for our spiritual development. It's so nice to see that our brain isn't going to be resistant to this change. It's actually going to be an assist. The other thing that happens, which is, I think, just very curious about how the brain is organized, it turns out that there are some discrete structures within the brain. In fact, we'll talk a little bit about the limbic system, the amygdala and hippocampus, a few structures tonight. But for many areas of the brain, they are organized more like committees. And so, for example, your speech center is over here on the left side of your head if you're a right-handed person. Well, it turns out if, let's say, you're majoring in French and you're trying to learn two other languages as well, so your speech center is under is being used a lot. Let's also say you're learning to play the piano, which it turns out is much of things that are related to music is also in this same area. In fact, it's kind of interesting if you look at very musical languages like Chinese, that it overlaps this music area and speech area. Very interesting how that is. Well, if you look at how the speech area is organized, if you put it under tremendous demand, like we said, you're learning several new languages, it begins to actually call out to the surrounding cells in a process they call recruitment. And it kind of says, guess what? We have spaces on the speech committee. Does anybody want to join? You're over in this parietal lobe associative area and not really being used. Why don't you join the speech committee? So your brain actually has some flexibility in how cells are assigned. In fact, this used to be another thing we misunderstood scientifically about the brain, was we thought that when a brain cell got a job, when it was done what we call differentiating, it stayed with that job, you know, for the rest of its incarnation as a cell. In the brain, it was just going to do that one thing. Well, now we know there's much more flexibility built into the brain cells, and they'll actually change function depending on what's required. So it really gives a much more hopeful view of the brain and changeability. And it's not surprising that the techniques we practice have some of the very rapid effects that they do in as short as 6 months or a year. Someone is really seeing their behavior, their way they interact with the world really changing. And some of this is because their brain and nervous system are cooperating in this shift and supporting them in this change because it's being transformed by our spiritual practices. So let me talk a little bit about a few structures in the brain. I think they're worth at least mentioning briefly. And one other thing that I think it's kind of fun to throw in because it's increasingly becoming important in medicine. So the structures in the brain I'll talk about are prefrontal lobes, limbic system, and its attendant structures, which include hippocampus and amygdala. And I'll talk about that a little bit, what those structures are and what they do, why they seem to have importance for us spiritually to think about. But I'd also like to talk briefly about the vagus nerve. And it's significant because it's popping up in medicine as something that people are really paying attention to. And guess what? Vagus nerve actually is something that may be one of the ways in which meditation has a profound effect on our physiology. And also, it's a way in which dietary measures seem to be affecting our nervous system in a way that is a little complex, but we'll get there. I'll take you through it. So let's talk about the structures in the brain. Well, the area of our brain which is the most refined, the most elegant, are the prefrontal lobe areas of our brain. And for example, when we're concentrating at the end of meditation, right in this area here, all our energy is focused in that area. If we actually did a functional MRI scan to see what parts of your brain were really metabolizing, really active, we'd find a lot of the metabolism would be happening right here in the prefrontal lobes of your brain. Turns out prefrontal lobes are really important because, you know, it's the area of our brain that's concerned with our ability to concentrate, our ability to complete tasks, our enthusiasm would be something associated with the prefrontal lobe. Someone, you know, and it's so many of these things, as I spiel them off, you'll notice that if you've been meditating a lot, you feel these effects and you see those changes in your behavior. And some of it is because your brain is cooperating with the change of augmenting the function of your prefrontal lobes every time you meditate. You know, one question I get asked a lot is, have they done studies to look at how much you need to meditate to get any effect? Like, kind of what's the bare minimum that someone needs to do? And actually, if I'm assigning one of my patients meditation as something to do at home, it can't be quite the way we do it spiritually. Would like, you know, really you want to start with 20 or 30 minutes twice a day, you know, or at least once a day and expand from there. And we really have to say, nope, it's 12 minutes, 14 minutes. It has to be real specific and as small as possible, because that's your best chance of actually getting them to do something like this, which may be helpful. And they've actually studied it. It's right around 12 to 15 minutes seems to be the magic amount daily for someone to begin getting benefit from meditation. So, you know, if you were enrolling people in a study, for example, and wanted to see if Hong Saw technique was helpful for ameliorating some of the effects of dementia, for example. And they've done studies like that. And they found that meditating 12 to 15 minutes a day with a concentration type technique, similar to Hong Saw technique, will actually improve people's cognitive function within 4 to 6 weeks. And the thing that I find very interesting about this is that the question you always want to ask is, well, when the study's done, how many people keep doing this? And you look at pain management studies where people have been taught to meditate for pain management, or where people were being treated for early dementia and cognitive problems with meditation. You often find very high levels of continued meditation in those people because they find it works and they know the medication alternatives really suck. So opiates or meditation, boy, how much nicer to meditate to manage my pain. You know, maybe I have to meditate 2 hours a day to control my pain, but that's so much better than being on OxyContin. So that's prefrontal lobes. Other things with prefrontal lobes, it's the part of our brain that is the executive and helps organize our memory. So if the prefrontal lobes are activated, it's much easier to lay down new memory. I don't know how many of you experienced this, but when you started meditating, it was like your ability to remember and learn things really dramatically improved. And this is actually a not surprising phenomenon, because it's like the prefrontal lobes, they act like the inlet gate to let information come in and get put in retrievable places in your brain so that you can access it later. With prefrontal lobes, it's also associated with our ability for creativity. I mean, obviously, if you're a painter, the visual cortex is going to be involved. If you're a musician, all the sound-related cortex is going to be involved. But it turns out the organizer with that is, again, the prefrontal lobes. So it's not surprising to see that people that are meditating regularly will often find that their creativity level improves and actually becomes much more focused. They're able to do more with that. And remember, creativity could be how you work with people. You're very creative at working with difficult people when other people have problems. In fact, there's one part of the prefrontal lobes that seems to be associated with how well we work harmoniously with other people. So it's, again, you know, you kind of go, well, I've activated the prefrontal lobes, and kind of automatically some of these other things begin to show up. People are much more harmonious. They can live in a small community like this and actually make it work and really be happy doing it. And meditation is one of the things that allows that, in part because the prefrontal lobes get activated so profoundly. Your basic level of happiness is a prefrontal lobe associated function. In fact, they've done studies looking at college students, where they could just look at a person's baseline prefrontal lobe function. These would be like sophomores in college, and they could predict the likelihood of them being a really good student and doing well in college or doing poorly with one little 3-minute test, just looking at how their prefrontal lobes functioned. And I remember when I saw that, I said, oh man, God bless meditation. Imagine, you know, you've been in the study and you find out you're in the lowest quartile, and everybody else in there, you know, is addicted to drugs or depressed or has other problems. You kind of go, well, what's going to happen to me? Well, the answer is you've got a choice. And that may be where your prefrontal lobe function is right now, but you could change that. Prefrontal lobes also exert a override effect on the limbic system. And the limbic system is that part of our brain which is associated with habits and more primitive emotions. If you've ever experienced being really frightened, panicked, if you've ever experienced being really angry about something, you can be pretty sure your limbic system was firing on all cylinders at that point. And in fact, it's what you kind of think about our limbic system. It was kind of built into us as a safety net. It's as though if you were a not very evolved human being and did not have prefrontal lobes that would be guiding your life, you could kind of function just from your limbic system. It'd be kind of a crude existence, but you'd know to stay out of the rain and eat and other things to reproduce. Many of these are kind of limbic system functions, but as we become more elegant creatures through our spiritual development, it's nice to know we can put limbic system to sleep. And actually, that's the way they talk about it. It begins to inhibit the function of the limbic system. And so it actually becomes unarousable. Kind of interesting way they put that. And they find that in longtime meditators that have been studied, they'll expose them to a loud noise like a gunshot in the background and then watch their brain waves echo that experience. Someone who is a non-meditator may, 5 minutes later, you may be seeing after effects in their brainwave function, still reporting that gunshot. It's sort of echoing around in their brain neurologically. Where in meditators, they actually have a bigger initial response. They actually note it more initially than the non-meditators, but then it dies out very quickly. It has a couple echoes and then dies out. Part of this is because limbic system is so quiet. It doesn't get involved and help persist these kind of echo-type phenomenons or create, you know, a panic-type situation. You can imagine someone being in a room and they say, okay, you're in the study. Here's your candy bar for being in the study. We're going to have you do arithmetic problems. Then somebody fires a gun off behind you. Well, I can imagine a few people getting pretty panicked by that. Well, you know, there's their limbic system getting, you know, involved. So that's prefrontal lobes and limbic system. Let me make a quick mention about amygdala. Amygdala is a part of the limbic system. It's attendant to it. There's two olive-sized amygdalae, one in each side of your brain. And these are the part of the brain that really is concerned with panic and fear. And it's also the area of your brain that encodes experience when you go to remember it based on its emotional value. And I mention this because it turns out that our brains are weighted much more in the direction, this is just sort of naturally, to encode negative things about 5 times more powerfully. So let's say you had 2 experiences today of equal value. One was positive, one was negative, but about the same degree. You're about 5 times more likely to remember the negative one neurologically. And this is part of the reason that we create this kind of different framework in our brain when we meditate to help us encode things a little bit differently. So when you have a very positive experience spiritually and you can kind of remember that, and I think many of you have probably had this where you'll experience something and then days later it's like, you know, I can't even remember really what I had for breakfast, but I remember that meditation and that feeling I had then. Well, part of that is amygdala helping coding that, saying, this is a really positive experience. I want to make sure we remember it. So it's nice to see how these structures play in even to the spiritual aspects of our lives and how they can actually be benefit. The one other neurological structure I want to talk about is the vagus nerve. Vagus nerve, interesting. 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't even have mentioned it, but I mention it now because it's being used so much medically. They found for a host of disorders, seizure disorders, depression, diabetes, obesity, that stimulating the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve runs from the center of the brain down through the thoracic and abdominal cavity. It's about as big around as your little finger. They call it the vagus nerve, the wandering nerve. Same vagus is the same root as vagrant. So it's this wandering nerve that comes down. And it turns out that it's one of the main ways that your body, particularly the organs in your body, communicate with your brain. And it's a bidirectional flow of information. Well, it's kind of interesting because, for example, when we're doing meditative practices, it really stimulates the vagus nerve. And so people are going in and getting vagus nerve implants to help with their seizure disorder or their depression that isn't being ameliorated any other way. And they get this vagus nerve implant, and it actually improves their depression or whatever other health issue. And boy, it is so nice to see us working with meditation as something preventive that automatically is stimulating our vagus nerve. For those of you who are Kriya Bonds and do the 3rd and 4th Kriya, pay attention to when you do the exhalation in that technique. You may feel some flushing kind of in your face, particularly when you do the 4th Kriya. If you've done a lot of rounds of the 4th Kriya, and you know what I'm talking about, you may feel kind of a flushing sensation in your face as you exhale. That's your vagus nerve getting stimulated. That's part of it. I mean, there's a spiritual part, energetic part. Those are happening simultaneous, but some of it is physiology. And I really think that's a great example for Kriya Bonds on, man, my vagus nerve is really getting stimulated with this technique. This is very, very positive. So they've even come up with vagus nerve stimulators now that don't have to be implanted, that they'll just be worn against the skin for more temporary treatments, where someone comes in and they're in a panic episode. Rather than giving them a medication by injection, you could just stimulate their vagus nerve with a thing you'd place against their skin. This is probably 5 years away, but it's fun from a neurological standpoint that some of the things that we are paying attention to on a daily basis are actually coming into the medical mainstream. So that's vagus nerve. Two other areas I'll mention briefly. A lot is happening in the field of our microbiome. When we talk about our microbiome, that's our body's microbial inhabitants. Turns out the vast majority of them are in the colon, in medically what we call the gut. And it turns out these guys are really important. Again, if you'd asked me 15 years ago, in fact, I'll tell you a true story. A friend of mine came up to me, a colleague, medical colleague, and he actually said, "You won't believe this. They're actually doing fecal transplants on people." Mm-hmm. And I burst out laughing. I just thought it was so absurd. There had to be a joke to this. You know, okay, what's the rest of the joke? And no, they really are doing fecal transplants. Well, why? To change people's microbiome. And that was the first I had heard of this concept. Well, boy, I can just feel Master smiling right now, because I spent 25, 30 years trying to figure out why Master talked so much about the gut. And don't get constipated. Eat this particular diet. And I would look at the foods on there and I go, yeah, well, this is a good, healthy diet. You could recommend that to anybody. But why those specific foods? And I'm beginning to think that part of the reason he suggested those things, because they have spiritual qualities, that's an important part of it, but they also have effects on our gut microbiome. And it turns out the inhabitants of our gut end up having a huge impact on our overall physical health. It can change your tendency toward becoming diabetic, to becoming obese, just depending on your gut inhabitants. And this isn't just looking at how could we change someone's gut who has a gut infection with like Clostridia difficile or C. diff. And that's actually being treated by giving people fecal transplants, healthy gut bacteria to replace it. But boy, right behind that is people looking at diabetes, obesity, depression. They actually have found that changing people's diet and putting specific strains of bacteria into their diet, or irrigating their colons with specific bacteria so that their gut microbiome changes in character, changes their tendency toward depression. So the idea of getting capsules of bacteria which are ideal for a person's microbial needs in future to treat their depression or anxiety disorder is not that far-fetched anymore. So, and it's also, I think we will see recommendations around diet. They're going to really mimic much more what Master was saying. You know, all these years, I would look at things Master said about diet and what we were recommending in medicine, and always, they never quite mesh. And dang it, if in the end Master was just right, I wish I'd just ignored all this stuff more and just gone for what Master said and, you know, adapted that in so it made sense. But he was right. So last thing I'll just mention very quickly, because I mentioned it in Sunday service, is what about our genetic material? And again, very exciting area. 10 years ago, if you'd said, oh, well, if you meditate or you live in a certain way, your genetic material will change over time. Well, I think my answer would have been, well, yeah, maybe it'll change. It'll get worse. But improving? I don't think so. You know, we had too much of an idea of it, sort of this cement, you know, little building blocks that are all in a certain pattern that replicate. Turns out it's much more flexible than anybody thought. Even the way DNA folds itself changes and changes its function just based on its folding. The other thing that is worth mentioning briefly is the health or ability of our DNA to replicate is very important for our longevity. If your DNA is able to replicate well, let's say each cell line that you create, as you create daughter cells, it's kind of interesting they use that term daughter cell. As you create daughter cells, usually there's somewhere between 20 and 25 replications before the DNA has sort of exhausted itself and that whole cell line closes out, and you start off with other cell lines doing that same function. Well, it doesn't have to do that many replications to wear out. In fact, if someone's DNA is very unhealthy, they may only get a few replications before any future cells coming from that begin to have encoding errors in the DNA. It begins copying itself poorly, sort of like a poor quality recording of someone speaking. You can kind of understand it, but there's static other things in the background that you end up with these errors being communicated to the daughter cells. And they've actually found that a person's life experience, what they're going through with their life, has a profound effect on the health of their DNA. Some of the early studies were looking at DNA health, and one of the main things that we look at with this is these end caps that are on the both ends of the DNA. You know, you've got your DNA, which is this double helix like this, and the strands are held together with these end caps called telomeres. If they're really healthy, they're chubby and long, and their ability to open and allow the DNA to unfurl, so you end up with two strands, and both strands replicates itself. So now you have two complete sets of DNA self-replicating, but it's done it because these healthy telomeres allow that to happen. Some of the early studies were looking at negative life experience and how that affects telomeres. So someone who grew up in a war-torn environment or in a ghetto with lots of violence, you would actually look at the telomeres on their cells and they would be short and thin. They would look more like someone who was 40 or 50 years old, but it would be in a 15-year-old. They went on studying this and they found that people who went from unhealthy lifestyles to healthy lifestyles, that in fact, the health of their DNA began improving. And so their DNA may have started off looking like they were age 50 when they were 45, but after 5 years of healthy diet, exercise, meditation, that their DNA looked more like a 40-year-old, where they had kind of burned off 10 years worth of aging by doing these very positive things that actually made their DNA healthier. So this is something more that you will hear about. You know, for example, when you go for a physical at the doctor, probably within 5 years, one of the things they will include is measuring your telomeres. It's actually becoming an easier thing to do. You can either measure one substance in your bloodstream called telomerase. It's the enzyme that allows the telomeres to open, and that's in direct proportion to how healthy the telomeres are. So you could measure that just as a substance. Or you can actually, with an automated little microscope, measure telomeres on average in a group of white blood cells. And that's actually a pretty good way of estimating telomeres in adults. So that, you know, just like we get blood work and look at our hemoglobin and our cholesterol, you'll probably be told about your telomere health in another 5 years. And all the more reason to be doing chorea. We want those long, chubby telomeres that chorea will give us. So anyway, that's just a little bit of an overview. And why don't I just open it up for questions?
Yeah,
Amygdala, and the two of them are amygdala. Yeah, but amygdala.
What is, and obviously one is related to remembering positive experiences, and one is related to sort of remembering and acting on negative.
What you can think about it is it encodes memory. As a memory is about to get laid down, if it has any kind of an emotional charge to it, positive or negative, it tends to make the encoding of that memory stronger, so it's easier to remember. It's just a way our nervous system works. And both amygdala, certainly if you're someone who your mental diet is persistent negative thoughts. Sometimes we'll call them ants on the brain, automatic negative thoughts. Some people just have persistent something, you know, I'm mad at my mother, I'm mad at my mother, I hate my mother, I'm mad at my mother. Well, mother's been dead for 30 years, but they still have this loop going, and that is sort of just reinforcing the negative aspect of encoding of their amygdala. Whereas the kriya bond, positive attitudes, it's going to tend to help us encode things a little bit differently and more in the direction of positive memory. So, yeah, it just has you remember better things, too.
So I'm not clear as to what is the value of recreating strands of our DNA. Why would we want that to be happening? Why is that healthier for us?
Oh, well, remember, you know, your cells only have a limited lifespan. I'm trying to remember, even for skeletal cells, it's something in the order of like 10 years, most of your skeletal cells have been replaced once. So there's this constant turnover in cells that's occurring, and you'd like to have those new cells that are coming in be with the best architecture as possible. And if our DNA is real healthy, it means all our subsequent cells are going to be as error-free as possible in terms of their genetic encoding. So that's how it would be helpful that way. And we talked a little this morning about epigenetics. I won't go into that again right now, just how our behavior actually can change some of these flexible, right now we kind of think of them as on-off genes. I think it's going to turn out to be even more complicated than that, and actually even a little more hopeful. Yes, actually, that's actually something worth looking at. It's Master's Daily Diet. You can certainly find it in Ananda materials. If you go to the Ananda website and poke around with that, you could probably find a talk on it, which will actually go into that quite a bit more and list all the things that he suggested. Consider it kind of a collection of foods that he suggests. Be sure to include these in your diet every day, or a generous amount of these specific foods. You know, it's like a handful of almonds. It's a little bit of yogurt. He called it clabbered milk. But again, it gets at that microbiome concept.
You said that now you're understanding some of the reasons why. Does the talk go into that, the connections that you're making with the diet?
No, actually it doesn't. I was thinking more just the way Master described that daily diet and all the details that go with that. My understanding has really been that there's this microbiome connection, and that some of these things may end up acting a little bit differently than we would think of them as just proteins, fats, carbohydrates, and minerals, vitamins, things like that. That's usually all we would think about in terms of nutrition. Turns out it's much more complicated. Each thing we eat is living food and has a microbial, has an effect on our gut microbiome.
So like the carrot top has... Do you understand the significance?
It's a very good question. I've wondered about this. I've wondered about it. It's a green leafy vegetable, and so it's going to have all the nutrients you'd expect to see in that. But I also wondered about it from a microbiome standpoint. Are there things that bacteria that grow in the top of a carrot, dirt, that's actually a very good comment. It may be that's a very good way to ingest healthy bacteria. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, there's something more going on with that, and why it's certainly let me relax a whole lot more and just say, this is a great way to eat. Just choose this. Yes.
I have two questions about chanting. One is, I've heard or read some that chanting can also stimulate the vagus nerve or pranayama. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Definitely pranayama. That's actually been studied. And again, those of you who are kriya bonds, think about that fourth kriya when you're doing it. You know, that you will actually feel your vagus nerve firing, I think. That's
not necessarily chanting.
I'd have to think about that. Okay. Just right off the top of my head, I don't know.
The other question about chanting is related to something that I saw on PBS, Dr. Amen, who was done a lot.
Dr. Amen, yeah.
One of the things that he said was that when you, he was comparing the picture of the brain when you're singing as opposed to when you're listening to music. Mm-hmm. He was saying that when you're singing, that the front of the brain is lighting up, but when you're listening, the back of the brain is lighting up. Do you have any information on that? Or is that, I always wonder if that's junk science or if it's real.
Well, actually, it kind of makes sense to me, because if you're passively doing anything, watching a movie, listening to music, a little less likely your prefrontal lobes are going to be lit up. If you're actually doing an active function, you know, if you're painting a picture, not just admiring a picture, if you're singing music, you actually have to concentrate. And there's more of that recruitment of the prefrontal lobes when you do that. So I think probably the MRIs would look different, in part because of that. You know, one other thing to say about the gut microbiome is that it actually ends up giving input to our brain via the vagus nerve. And again, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have believed if somebody said that you have an enteric nervous system that is affecting your mood. But now we know it's true. And so depending on the kind of bacteria growing in your gut, there's actually nerve fibers that surround the gut that take information based on the inhabitants of your gut and send that information via the vagus nerve up to your brain, and your brain will act on it.
That's why you have a gut feeling.
Why you have a gut feeling, yeah. Or you're upset and you feel kicked in the gut, yeah. Question.
Eating sugar, a lot of us talk about if it's not good for us, we don't feel good after we've eaten it. And I guess I notice it in myself. And so that could have the enteric nervous system could be affecting the vagus nerve in a different way. Or, you know, because the bacteria in the gut must change as what you put in it.
Absolutely.
And so if you eat a lot of sugar, then there's going to be maybe
different inhabitants and different messages being sent to your brain via the vagus nerve. Yeah.
Do you think that that could be why once you start eating sugar, you want more?
Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah. I think that's part of it, is there's definitely a positive neural feedback that this is something that will make me better, just like smoking. You know, your brain kind of gets hooked on that. And part of that is how it affects your gut bacteria, how that information gets communicated to your brain via the vagus nerve. Not just the direct effects of the sugar in your bloodstream, but there's actually this other thing that's happening as well and why it may be significant. In fact, you know, it's surprising the number of medications that we prescribe pharmaceutically that we thought worked in a specific way with a disease process. A really good example is diabetes and the medication metformin. I don't know how many of you have heard that. Very, very common medication we use, oral medication we use in diabetes management. And it turns out it may be the most important effect it has to cause blood sugar lowering is how it changes your gut bacteria. And in reflex to that, your diabetes control is better. And it may be primarily because of how it affects your gut bacteria. And metformin actually kind of causes stomach upset in people. They get diarrhea on it. And so we kind of knew it did something with your gut, and that often limited its use. But we're seeing in other medications too, we're kind of finding that their effects may not be the direct pharmacologic effects. It's a secondary effect on your gut and your gut back on your body that may be a factor of this. So I think it's fun just to say some of this because we can see how these things are interconnected.
Yeah, You had also mentioned that the vagus nerve affects your weight or obesity.
It can.
And how can you say more about that? Or, like, if I ate certain foods, then I would be less likely to eat as much? Or
boy, that is a very good question. I think there's a couple questions there. What about the vagus nerve and weight loss and exercise? They are doing studies on that right now, looking at actually using vagus nerve stimulation, with a little implant, and people haven't been able to lose weight any other way. But it's kind of raised the question is, what if we had other ways of stimulating the vagus nerve, maybe not as strongly, but doing it persistently and regularly, like with meditation, would make sense that we might see some similar effects. Also, the kind of diet you're eating, it's kind of raised some very interesting questions. Is we know now that what we've been recommending to people for weight loss really doesn't work. I know the last big study I read about was within the last year, and it's like under 5% of people who are more than 20 or 30 pounds overweight at any point in their adult life lose it and keep that weight off. I mean, it's pretty grim news. That's 1 in 20 people is able to actually effectively lose weight. So whatever we're recommending right now has not been working well. And I'm glad we're looking at some of these other techniques. And some of them may come down to having people really re-engineer their diets in ways that are much more weight loss friendly, not because of the amount of calories they're eating, but because of the kinds of foods they're eating and the effect on our microbiome. I think that is coming.
The question kind of relating to third and fourth on Kriyas.
Sure.
Experience mild positional vertigo right now, and it seems that it almost has the same effect as the third and fourth Kriya, and the maneuver they have to overcome it has a lot of similarity.
Yeah, a benign positional vertigo, or BPV. It turns out, our balance mechanism is based on our three little semicircular canals in the deep part of our ear on both sides. And they're oriented like this, and like that. So anytime you move your head, these little canals, which are filled with fluid called endolymph and have little hairs on the inside, so when that fluid moves, your brain knows that you have moved because those little hairs get jostled by the movement of the fluid. Here's the problem is people can form little crystals in the endolymph. And when that happens and you move your head in just the right way, instead of the fluid just kind of moving through and doing enormous stimulation, it hits that little blockage, that stone, literally, and you get this incessant firing right from that one place, and you feel like you're spinning or tumbling. That's benign positional vertigo. And the maneuvers you're describing, they're called the Epley maneuvers. It's kind of a fun story. Dr. Epley was this neurologist who was trying to find ways to help people with these episodes of vertigo being caused by these little stones. So he actually developed this, it almost looked like a carnival ride in his office, where he'd put people in there and he'd flip them up and down and spin them around. And a lot of times it would pop these little stones free and their benign positional vertigo would go away. People would come from all over the country to have treatments with him. And it's very interesting. His medical assistant one day said, we pop people upside down. Why don't we just have them turn their head? And he said, well, that's a good idea. And so we ended up with the Epley maneuvers, which are these very abrupt head movements done. And it actually just stresses the fluid in the semicircular canals, pops the little crystal free, and it moves on, and you don't have BPV anymore. Most people, that's what happens.
Where does the crystal go?
It actually goes into a little area where it gets reabsorbed. Yeah.
So what did that have to do with the third and fourth Kriya?
I can't say too much about that because we're not all third and fourth Kriya bonds.
It's starting to sound like the third and fourth Kriya are working on the cranial nerves. How different?
Oh, well, it's very interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, it's Yeah, yeah. It has a different kind of effect on our nervous system than the first and second chorea, definitely. And yeah, many people find that is kind of their favorite chorea to do.
Dichotomy with memory. I have a very, very, very good memory for music. I'm sure I know hundreds and hundreds of songs, some of which I wish I didn't remember. But going back to when I was very young, I always liked to sing. But then my other memory is not always the best. And like I was reading and looking at a book that I had read many years ago, and I didn't remember anything that I had read about it. So I just remember right now how you talk about memory. You said something about memory being in the same place, matter whether it's music or not.
No, actually, it's scattered in multiple areas throughout the brain. And actually, it's a pretty complicated topic to get into. But what I will say about it is it can be placed in a way that is easily retrieved or very difficult to retrieve. And that's one of the benefits that we see in meditators is it tends to lay down their memory in ways that is a little more easily retrieved. And so, you know, feeling like your memory is better and you're kind of smarter after 6 months of meditation, that's a real experience because your brain is actually functioning in a way which is better. And, you know, it's not surprising as the brain ages, you know, for any of us in our 60s, 70s, 80s, we may notice certain aspects, for example, of memory are not working as well. But you may have areas that are really well preserved. And some people, it's music. You know, they can sing you all the songs from an opera and remember all the words in Italian. But they're having trouble with their phone number. So it's kind of how those things are laid down. It may have a little bit to do with how amygdala encoded them, too. Because if you love music and enjoy music, you preferentially encoded those in ways easier to go in and snatch.
Yeah. And that's why Swami's music was so powerful, too.
Yes.
And people got where they might forget a lecture or the points he made. You set it to music that's enlists more of your brain.
Absolutely. And, you know, just to add on that, it turns out when your brain is interpreting music, it actually does two things. It actually listens to the lyrics and pays attention to them and interprets them, and it also listens to the music. So if you're listening to music, you really enjoy the melody, but it has horrible lyrics, your brain is hearing the lyrics too. That's why it's very helpful to listen to Swami's music. It has wonderful lyrics, uplifting lyrics, have it playing in the background. It's actually, your brain is listening to that. Even if you're not, your brain is.
Is the vagus nerve, does it block the other nerves? I mean, why, like when people have anxiety and you can stimulate the vagus nerve, so does that stop something? Does the vagus nerve stop?
Well, actually, in some people, when you stimulate the vagus nerve, it has a calming effect on the brain. And they may be heading into, you know, a panic state, and they turn on their little vagus nerve stimulator and stimulates their vagus nerve and calms down the panic attack that way.
But sometimes it stimulates other parts of the body, and sometimes it calms them down, the vagus.
Kind of depends on its function. I'll be honest with you, we're just beginning to understand everything that the vagus nerve could potentially do. But I kind of gave you a good overview on the things that we're thinking about with that. Yeah. And any of you who've ever been standing and all of a sudden kind of felt lightheaded, like you're going to faint, and maybe you do faint, we actually call that vasovagal syncope. Syncope is falling down, going unconscious, but vasovagal is the vagus nerve has this big discharge and tends to slow your heart rate, lower your blood pressure. And so, you know, the classic thing of, you know, here's the husband there at his wife's giving birth, and he takes one look at this thing coming at him and passes out. First baby I delivered, that happened to me. The husband passed out and hit his head on the floor. So everybody went to take care of him, and it was me delivering the baby. I kept saying, come on, guys, I've not done this before, poor mom. Anyway, question?
I've been taking rather seriously lately Swami's suggestion that in order to improve the memory, one ought to concentrate single-mindedly on everything you do. It's close to a quote, okay? So, in that spirit, I look at my habit of constantly listening to Swami's music, for example, in the background, while I eat breakfast, while I read the funnies. Okay, now, so I'm concerned about these things, and I'm really, really seriously thinking about getting rid of the funnies altogether, and all the reading and so forth, and just concentrate on the eating. Now, you mentioned that there's an inherent blessing to listening to Swami's music in the background. How does that work with your single-mindedness versus your multi-thoughts?
Get rid of breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah, there's her weight loss. Yeah. I would keep the music. Yeah. Just consider that part of the ambiance of the situation, and you can still focus on your food. Yeah.
I've always thought it was hugely beneficial.
Yeah. Just like with you focusing, you know, if you're focused on a project, you'd probably like to be in a room that was a comfortable temperature, didn't have a bad smell in it. Those kinds of things. I would kind of see that as part of the ambiance.
The vagus nerve again, and things like tapping and acupressure and qigong that talk about this spot for relieving anxiety and such. Which came first? That's about the energy pathway. Is it related?
Oh man, boy, that is a very good question. And in fact, it's kind of interesting how life is. But when I was in medical school, you know, I kind of wondered what I was doing there. And when I was in neurology, I was very interested in the nervous system. But what I got interested in was the effects of this illegal practice in California called acupuncture. My acupuncture teacher went to jail for a week for practicing acupuncture. This was before Nixon went to China. And acupuncture was legal in California. And literally, when we'd go for our training sessions with him, we'd go knock on his door, and he had one of these little peephole windows. It'd snap open, and he'd say, "Who are you?" And we kind of had to give, "Well, it's just us, your students, we're paying you." And, "Okay, come in." You know, he'd snap the whole thing closed. And actually, the studies being done at that point were looking at how our nervous system seems to overlap with a lot of acupuncture, acupressure points, and trying to make some sense of that. They didn't really make much sense of it, but I think there is something there. So
with the microbiome and taking antibiotics, mm-hmm. that really changes that. Do you have any recommendations?
Boy, and my recommendation has changed substantially in the last 20 years. I think what I would say is, you know, while you're taking antibiotics, I mean, if it's you're taking them appropriately, you know, definitely, I think emphasizing probiotic foods in your diet, fermented foods, yogurt, clabbered milk, as Yogananda would have called it, helpful things to do, even though some of those are going to get wiped out by the antibiotics, and then kind of see it during treatment phase. You're doing that, but then you really continue it for at least a few weeks afterwards of really emphasizing lots of fermented, healthy probiotic and prebiotic foods. Prebiotic foods are ones that have lots of inulin in them, like garlic, jicama. They're non-absorbable fibers. Yeah, I'm not saying that right. Insoluble fibers. They're insoluble fibers that gut bacteria really like. You can even buy inulin if you get tired of eating jicama. Yeah, if you get tired of eating jicama and Jerusalem artichoke, you can actually just take inulin. It's kind of interesting because there have been some studies looking at the doxycycline or tetracycline-like antibiotic minocycline that actually it seems to have a very positive effect on some people's gut bacteria. It's One thing that I've heard from people in the past, that particularly when they were teenagers and they were taking tetracycline for acne, that their health sometimes was a lot better, and they kind of wondered what that was about. They'd sometimes ask me, you know, the healthiest I ever was the 5 years I took tetracycline as a teenager for my acne. And actually, it kind of makes some sense right now. There may have been something, the way it groomed their microbiome. We may be recommending that to people at some point in the future, is we need to re-sculpt your microbiome, and so we're going to feed you good, healthy microbiome components, and maybe we'll wipe out a few with a short course of minocycline, tetracycline-like antibiotic, and help re-groom or re-sculpt your microbiome.
Very interesting that you say that. I have a who called me about 6 or 8 months ago, said to me, "You're going to think I'm absolutely nuts." That's how he prefaced what he was about to say. But he says the only time that he has a little tendency towards depression, or really like a dysthymia kind of thing. He says, "I only feel good when I'm on doxy for my skin."
Isn't that interesting? I have heard that from patients before. Yeah, with a little bit of depression disorder, they'll often find it just kind of goes away.
He's about the third person, but he was so clear about it. Mm-hmm. So he's asking me to prescribe it. And I'm thinking, how do I make sense of that? You know, worried about his gut, but then maybe it is his gut that's making him feel better.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hoping we'll have an answer to that question in the next few years.
Is there anything we can read or that you recommend? Or, I mean, you can go on the internet and find all kinds of stuff.
Oh, boy. I'll just make this as a recommendation. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I post a fair amount of stuff about prebiotics and the gut microbiome that I think are reasonable articles, probably 2 or 3 a week. Might be a good place to start.
A lot of changes in the brain. Can you recommend that?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's an excellent book for any yogi. Worth reading. Yeah. How God Changes the Brain. Yeah. By Alfred Newberg. Yeah. Very, very well written, very available. I must admit I was a little depressed after I read it, because I realized, well, he wrote the book I would have loved to have been able to write, and it's so much better than I would have done. So, how humorous. Yes.
I was just curious that if people are not liking certain probiotics, for example, my father, so he probably more naturally eats some of those things, if you were to take it in a pill form, is that even a good alternative, or just...
You know, I've often wondered what Master would say if we asked him that same question. And I think probably what he would say is, well, eat the natural food, the food that has life force in it and other very positive qualities. But I wouldn't be surprised if he would say, if they're not going to get it in any other way, give them a pill that has probiotics in it. Interesting. Good practical solution.
I think it is important, though, that not all probiotics are equal.
Right.
And to talk to somebody who really knows what you're taking and to take.
Yeah, some of the ones you'll just find in the grocery store that only have one thing in them, they're the ones that are most commonly advertised when you walk down the aisle. I'm sure they're okay, but I'm not really sure how much benefit people are actually going to get. Some of them, when they study them, it turns out that none of the bacteria actually makes it to your gut, which is kind of the whole point of taking it. But nowadays, there's good quality probiotics available. Usually, I look for ones that have, you know, 5 or more billion colonies per capsule. It's nice if it's an enteric-coated capsule. I think there's something to be said for that, so it gets through the stomach without just getting destroyed by the acid in your stomach. And, you know, there's probably 10 or 15 different strains that are helpful, that we understand are helpful already, and you can get those all in one little capsule now. Yes.
And I don't know if people down here, but people at the village have kefir starters that you can use dairy with, or you can even use water with. And it's a fermented product. It's probiotic. And you can make your own.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for just eating more fermented foods. And there's a lot of really fun fermented foods out there. I don't know how many of you have eaten kimchi. It's a good way to open your sinuses up. I'm actually saying that as a little bit of a joke. I don't eat it when I'm going to do patient care. Let's put it that way. It's so full of garlic. But eating a little bit of yogurt every day, live culture yogurt, good idea. Master would have recommended that. Did recommend it.
I had a question about back to meditation, Peter, uh-huh. which of course is such a cornerstone of this path. And you talked a lot about, you know, there's the minimum and various of all the studies that have been done. And we just see that meditation has become so mainstream now.
I know, we can actually discuss it with our patients, and it's not the M word anymore. Boy, not much. What about studies on Kriya in particular? In fact, it's kind of interesting you brought that up because we just wrote, we're writing a big grant for our clinic, and I'm getting an EEG. So we're going to have our own little EEG, and Purushottam and I are going to study brainwaves. In fact, I'd really like to see what happens when you train, you know, our patients that we're seeing who've never meditated into something like Hong Saw, or we'll see. We'll kind of have to figure out what's appropriate for our population, how that changes their brainwave patterns. But I'd also like to see, you know, start hooking up our longtime Kriyamans and kind of see what their brainwave patterns look like at rest and what they look like when they're doing the different Kriyas. Yeah, exciting times. Yeah.
It kind of goes along with your talk at Sunday service about self-effort as necessary and grace with Kriya. I mean, we can do what we can with our diet and with our meditation practice, but thank goodness there's a whole Guru's grace coming in to amplify our efforts.
Yeah. Anybody else? Oh, thank you. It's just so lovely being down here. I just, I didn't even get to come to that much of last night, but you could just feel the energy here last night. It was, it was just, why am I preparing a talk when I should be meditating? And it's very interesting. It was palpable. So, well done.